Evergreen Sermons Online and Pastor Michael Gabbert's Wednesday night series, First Corinthians Church for Broken People. This message from November 6, 2019 is entitled Idols and Demons, citing 1 Corinthians 10:1 through 11:1. We apologize for the technical difficulties, and this message will end after 37 minutes.
Well, let me talk to you tonight about 1 Corinthians. If it makes you feel any better, we're going to start the 10th chapter, which is my least chapter in the book, my least favorite chapter in the entire book. So let's just see if we can get through this together, okay? When I was in Thailand a number of years ago, I had what was for me a very disturbing experience. I went with our hosts up to early in the morning, one morning. I went up to the top of a mountain where the Buddhist monks came out of their temple. And the way Buddhist monks gain their support is through, I call it begging, but they say that it's in blessing and receiving. What happens is a Buddhist monk is not allowed to work for money, so they regularly go out into the general public carrying a bowl, and the bowl is a sign of, it's like an offering plate. I mean, it doesn't look like an offering plate, but that's what it is. And what they do is people will give them an offering and then kneel to receive a blessing from the monk. And so there was a place early in the morning that was known, and the monks would all come out of the monastery and they would be here, and people would come and bring offerings. And it had become kind of a tourist attraction because there were actually booths set up where you could buy offerings, food and other things to put in the bowls of the monks. And I was there, and you know, I experienced this in a number of different places. Like this summer we were in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, in Vatican City, and I stayed as long as I could stay, and then I had to leave because my soul was churned up. I mean, just what I saw there that I felt like was such a it was such a dishonoring pretense. And I just thought Peter was probably spinning in his grave at what had been done in his name. Well, I felt that way in Thailand on this mountaintop, because as I'm watching these people, and they pay money and they bring these offerings and they put them in the bowl, and here's what I saw. The monks, because they're reciting blessings that are just standard fare, the person would give the offering and then kneel down, and the monk would recite the blessing and not be engaged at all. The whole time he's reciting the blessing over this person, he's surveying where the next gift might come from. And he's saying the words and he's repeating the blessing, and he's looking around, and as soon as he finishes, the person, you know, clasps their hands and bows, and the monk is off to his next target. And I use that language on purpose. And so my soul was already churned. I was agitated, if you will, by what I saw as spiritual pretense and falsehood. But the topper was when a bus pulled up, and pouring off of this bus was a collection of American tourists. Clearly Americans. You don't mistake Americans anywhere in the world. You know who they are. So this tour bus of Americans got off, and one of them, you know, we were just milling around, and one of them noticed me, knew that I was an American, struck up a conversation, and so I said, you know, well, who are you, where are you from, blah, blah, blah. And he said, well, we're a senior adult group from blah, 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 Methodist Church in Houston, Texas. And we were taking this international tour. You know, some people go to Israel. They'd gone to Southeast Asia. They were in Thailand. And they had come to this tour spot to see the Buddhist monks. But what really agitated me, I mean, to the point that I had to just bite my tongue and leave, was that these American Methodists went over to the shops, bought the offerings, came, kneeled down before the monks, gave the offering to receive the blessing. Now, I know that they just viewed it as a photo op. I mean, they were just, you know, adding a little local color to their trip. But in my mind, I'm thinking, do you not have any idea the spiritual realities that you're toying with here? This is not a tourist attraction. This is not a photo op. This is not a quaint little practice from Asia that you want a photograph of. I mean, you could have put a gun to my head and I was not going to kneel before one of those Buddhist monks. I mean, it's not going to happen. That's what this chapter in 1 Corinthians is about. At first glance, chapter 10 of 1 Corinthians appears to be a rehash. We've already, a couple of chapters ago, had Paul's extended conversation about the question of meat sacrificed to idols. And he took us through an examination of that, basically saying, we know that idols are just wood or stone. There's nothing to them. They're not real. So meat sacrificed to idols is no thing. So if you eat the meat, there's no spiritual negative to it. It's a morally neutral action. But he says in that chapter, but you may want to consider not doing it on the outside chance that it hurts the conscience of a weaker brother who's not yet to the place of recognizing that there's nothing there, that it doesn't mean anything. So in order to not offend someone who doesn't fully grasp the insignificance of that action, you should refrain. And Paul basically says, I would refrain from all foods if that's what it took to protect the conscience of someone who is still growing spiritually. Well, we get to this chapter, and Paul he circles back around to this same topic, only now he's going to explore it from a different angle. And in the last time, where he basically said, it doesn't mean anything, but don't do it if it's going to hurt somebody else's impression of the Christian faith, if it's going to hinder their growth. Now he's going to come back around to the topic, only now he still believes that there's nothing to idols. They're just wood or stone or some other substance. And meat sacrificed to that idol, in and of itself is no big thing. But what he's going to talk about in this chapter that he didn't talk about the first time around was to those people who felt strong enough to do this, he wants them to understand that the worshiper who sacrifices to an idol, while we know that there's nothing about the sacrifice that's significant, and there's nothing about the idol that's significant, what that worshiper who thinks he's sacrificing to the God represented by that idol, what he doesn't understand is there really is a spiritual force that is malevolent that's behind that idol. In other words, he's going to tell us that when we sacrifice meat to idols, we don't mean to worship demons, but demons, as malevolent spiritual entities, demons take advantage of the emptiness, of the vacuum that's involved in idolatry. And so what he's going to come back around and say, while we don't do this because we mean to protect the weaker brother, he's going to come back around to those who are strong and say, but here's why, even for you, you probably shouldn't do this. So it feels like a little bit of a rerun, but it's really not. As you see on the outline that I've given you, I've called this Idols and Demons, and I want us to just work through this chapter. It's a little bit tedious, and like I said, it's my least favorite chapter just because it's kind of hard to grasp the flow of thought, but in this chapter there are a couple of standout verses that are just awesome. So let's see what we can draw from this. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, beginning in verse 1. We'll start with the first five verses. I called this the dangers of idolatry highlighted, and I mentioned the references to history. So let's look at the first five verses. He says, "Now I want you to know, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud, all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from a spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But God was not pleased with most of them, for they were struck down in the wilderness." References to history. Paul is talking to a primarily Gentile audience, but because he views the church as the true Israel, the completion of what God was doing with Israel. Now, that's not to say that Israel has been set aside. There are some theologies that hold what's called replacement theology, and that is the Jews have been tossed overboard, the church is the replacement. The image that Paul uses is that Gentiles have now been grafted into a tree that has Judaism as its root. And we know from Romans chapters 9 through 11, Paul talks about how God will use this era where the gospel has success among Gentiles to lead to a time when the Jews, really out of jealousy, will find their way back to their Messiah. So this is not the idea that the Jews have been tossed overboard or set aside, but he does believe that the church grafted into Israel like branches on a tree, they have inherited the things that God intended all along for his people. So even though he's talking to a Gentile audience, he goes back to the Old Testament and just has a whole plethora of Old Testament references, and we're just gonna highlight some of these. Some of them I'll read, some of them I'm just gonna give you the references and you can look them up on your own if you're interested in that. But let's look and see these references to history. He starts by saying, now I want you to know, brothers, and that's a standard introduction that Paul uses. He's used it in other letters. It's a way of saying, I want you to pay attention because I'm about to give you something new that you didn't know. I want you to catch this. It's important. So I want you to know, brothers, that our fathers, meaning the Old Testament saints, particularly Israel, were all under the cloud, all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. He's referring to, if you can remember your Old Testament history, he's referring at this point to Exodus chapters 13 and 14. What happened in Exodus 13 and 14 is Israel, the 10 plagues have happened in Egypt. Pharaoh has released the Israelites. They've plundered Egypt and taken the wealth of Egypt, and they've left. And just as they've left and gone out into the desert, Pharaoh changes his mind. He decides to assemble his army and to chase after the Israelites and bring back the slaves that have now, in his mind, wrongfully escaped. Israel, from the time they left Egypt, has been following a cloud. The cloud is called the Shekinah glory. It is a physical manifestation of the glory of God. It was a cloud by day, a pillar of cloud, that they could see the whole assembly of Israelites, maybe as many as a million plus Israelites. It was tall enough that even those in the back could see, and the cloud would lead them each day in the direction that they were to go. At night, the pillar of cloud would become a pillar of fire, so it could still be seen. As they're traveling, they arrive at the Red Sea, and they are faced with the prospect of having to cross over the Red Sea. The cloud has led them to this place when they realize that behind them is approaching the most powerful army of the strongest nation on the planet at that time. The Egyptian army is coming, and they panic. And what happens is the cloud that is in front of Israel ascends above the people and moves over the nation and takes a position behind them and stands as a barrier preventing the Egyptian army from reaching the Israelites. with God sort of guarding the flank of the nation, Moses, following instructions, raises his staff, and by the hand of God, it says that the waters part, and they create basically walls, and through an entire night, the nation of Israel walks through the ocean, through the sea, on dry land. Now we know how this story ends. The cloud returns to the front of Israel at the end of that night. They've passed through. The Egyptian army races into the breach of the water, and God proceeds to fold the water over the Egyptian army, and they are drowned in the Red Sea. Paul's using poetic language here, but he's describing those historical events in spiritual language. And this is what he means. He says, our fathers were all under the cloud. That is, the cloud was in front of them. It ascended until it passed over them and took up its place in the rear of the people. They were all under the cloud. They all passed through the sea, the crossing of the Red Sea, and they were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. That is, baptized into Moses is a strange phrase, but it really shouldn't be baptized. It shouldn't be translated baptized. Baptized is an English transliteration of a Greek word. In the King James era, when the authorized version, 1611, published under King James, when he assembled a team to publish an English translation of the Bible, they had a problem. And the problem was the Anglican Church, for generations, ever since Henry VIII, they had practiced infant baptism. As they began to study the Greek of the New Testament, what they came to understand is the Greek word baptizo is a word that means immersion or submersion. In other words, the biblical mode or style of baptism is to be immersed or submerged completely underwater and then brought back. It's the way that we do it. It paints a picture of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's a testimony of the death of the old man raised to live a life in Christ for the rest of our days. A testimony of what's happened in us and a declaration of what Christ did for us. That's the picture of baptism. The Puritan fathers, though, said, if we translate this immersed, we're going to unbaptize the entire nation of England, because they've all been baptized as babies. So they came up with a compromise. They said, let's not translate it, let's transliterate it. So what they did was they took the Greek letters and they just substituted the English letters and they invented a new word, the word baptize. It comes from baptizo. Well, now you have denominations hundreds of years later who practice all different styles of baptism, and they all justify it by saying, well, baptism can be lots of things. No, it can't. It's, the word literally means immerse, submerge, to be placed completely underwater. All right, that was an unnecessary diversion, but that's a kind of a pet peeve of mine. The reason I say that is because that's the word that he's using here, but he doesn't mean it in the technical ritual sense of baptism. He means it in the actual sense of the word immersed. When he speaks about being baptized into Moses, Moses represents the law that would come to define Judaism. As the people of God, the tablets that would define the law, as well as all of the other laws that are given to us in Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, that came to be associated so clearly with Moses that to be baptized into Moses was to be immersed into Judaism, to become a part of the people of God defined by those who observe the law. What he's saying here is that our forefathers by that action of God covering them with a cloud, by passing through the sea, by all of those historical events, they were immersed in what came to define them as the people of God that we know as Israel. He goes on to say, they all ate the same spiritual food. Well, he's talking about manna. That the reference for manna is Exodus 16. And then Exodus 17 refers to the next part where he says they all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank from a spiritual rock. There are two episodes, one at the beginning of their pilgrimage and one at the end of the pilgrimage, where Moses used his staff to strike a rock in the middle of the desert and fresh water sprang out and the people had water in the desert because of a supernatural intervention that provided water, in the same way that the manna was a supernatural intervention that provided food. What he's saying is, all of this was God making a way for his people to have everything they needed to be fully useful for his purposes. He was creating a nation, and in the process of creating a nation, he immersed them in the law so that they had a corporate identity. He sustained them in the difficulty of the wilderness by providing a spiritual food and providing a spiritual drink. Now, there is kind of an allusion here. It says that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. Because there was an episode at the beginning of the wilderness and at the end of the wilderness where Moses gets water out of a rock, there came to be a Jewish legend that the rock that provided water supernaturally followed Israel through the desert and provided water for them whenever they had need. Now, that's a Jewish legend that's not in Scripture, but Paul may be speaking to that popular understanding that the rock followed him. But I think the reason he was willing to use that is because he's going to make an even greater spiritual application, and he says that rock was Christ. In other words, everything that was being done in the Old Testament to create a useful people of God was ultimately Jesus in the early stages of providing what was necessary to get to the place where Paul and the Corinthians were right now, which is Christ now having come and brought in the fulfillment of the kingdom. Verse 5. But even with all of that, divine intervention against the Egyptian army, divine intervention to cross the Red Sea, divine intervention to provide food in the desert, divine intervention to provide water, not once but twice. But God was not pleased with most of them, for they were struck down in the wilderness. Now that is one of the great understatements of the Bible. God was not pleased with most of them. In fact, everybody but two died in the wilderness. Now you remember that story. This was Moses sending scouts into the promised land to come back with a report. The question in Moses' mind when he sent the scouts was not whether we will go into the promised land, but what is the most advantageous course for us to pursue to conquer the promised land. Moses was not asking for a majority vote. He was not asking for the people to decide if they would do that. They had been instructed by God to take this land. They'd been promised that the land had been preserved for them. They'd been promised that God would go before them and clear the way. Moses was just trying to get the lay of the land so he could map out his strategy. Instead, 12 spies came back. 10 of them gave a negative report and said, "There's giants in the land. We can't take it." And the people's hearts melted. They began to grumble and complain. "Why have you brought us out here into the wilderness to die? We should have just stayed in Egypt." Now think about that. They were so spiritually rotten that the alternative of moving into the promised land by trusting God was to go back to Egypt where they had been slaves for 400 years. They said, "You know, we had such good things to eat in Egypt." No, they didn't. In fact, when Moses goes and finds them in slavery, they're boiling leeks to make onion soup. I mean, they lived on a subsistence diet. They had nothing for generations. But now all of a sudden, the risk of having to have faith in this invisible God leads them to begin to say, well, we should have just stayed in Egypt. We had it pretty good back there. You know, it's funny how the good old days, if you really stop and think through it, they weren't all that good. We have a way in human nature of sort of romanticizing our past. You know, we see, back in the good old days were not that great. Certainly in this story. So out of these references to history, he's going to give us some lessons. And these are, I don't want to read much of these. I'll give you references, okay? In verse 6, he says, now these things became examples for us so that we will not desire evil things as they did. Now, that's a great verse because the word that's translated desire there is the Greek word that's often translated lust. And I want to talk to you about that because lust is a word that we confuse sometimes. We think lust is just about sexual immorality. But the word lust in Greek can literally be translated. I mean, it's a combination word, and it's about three words that have been put together. And it's a word that literally means to have an appetite that boils inside of me. I'm sorry, it's not me. We're struggling with our technology right now. The word literally means to have an appetite that boils inside of me until it bursts out. Until it, like a pot that boils over. Lust is any appetite that churns in me until it's uncontrollable and it's just spilling out. Here he says, we've been given these lessons. These events were examples to the people they happened to. But now in Christ, looking back, all of the, and by extension, he means all of the Old Testament. All of the Old Testament, they were examples for the people that they happened to, but in Christ, they now become warnings for us so that we'll know not to lust after evil things like they did. And then he's just gonna run down a list. He starts by saying, verse 7, don't become idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and got up to play. The first one, he says, don't become idolaters. Now, the reference here, he quotes Exodus 32, verse 6. That is the passage where Moses goes up on the mountain, and while he's gone, his stay in the presence of the Lord is a little bit extended, and so they begin to think that something's happened and he's not coming back down. They convince Aaron to fashion a golden calf, and they have a big party. And that verse in Exodus 32, verse 6, says something like the people, well, he quotes it here, the people ate and drank, and then they got up to play. But it's not a wholesome kind of play. It's the kind of debauchery that was so associated with idolatry. See, here's the thing. When you worship a false god, where worship of Jesus Christ, where worship of the one true God elevates us, it draws us up to something better than who we are. When you worship a false god, it allows you to descend into the lowest forms of who we are. Idolatrous worship throughout history has been accompanied by the most horrendous human behaviors. Temple prostitutes and other such practices. So he says, don't become idolaters because it's so often accompanied by debauched behavior. Then he says in the next verse, let us not commit sexual immorality as some of them did. And in a single day, 23,000 people fell dead. Here the reference is to Numbers chapter 25, verses 1 through 5. It's a scene where the Israelites end up accepting the invitation of Moabite women, and they worship false gods and have sexual relations with pagan women who entice them. So the same formula is in each of these verses. Don't become adulterous like some of them did. Don't practice sexual immorality like some of them did. Verse 9, let us not test Christ as some of them did and were destroyed by snakes. This reference is Numbers 21, verses 5 and 6. It was the episode where their ingratitude for all that God had done was responded to by God sending snakes into the camp and causing several thousand people to die by poisonous snake bite. It was a statement, when they say don't test Christ, or it literally means don't tempt Christ, it was a statement that their ingratitude was received by Christ as a rejection of his blessings. And to reject God's blessings, to express a lack of thanksgiving, brings divine judgment. Now think about that. How do you feel when you do something for somebody? I mean, you really put yourself out. You go all out. And you make a special gift, or you prepare a special meal, or you do something that's a huge inconvenience, and you do it, and you really do it out of the goodness of your heart. And their response is, oh, well, I guess that'll have to do. Your natural reaction is to say, well, I'm not doing that again. Well, what he's talking about is God had done all of these things for Israel. They were a chosen people. God went out of his way to bless them in remarkable ways, not simply to bless them, but because his blessing of Israel was meant to be a testimony to all the surrounding nations that Israel's God was the God you wanted to serve. You wanted to be before this God. And yet, instead of broadly proclaiming, we have the best God of all, Israel became entitled, and their attitude was, yeah, well, that's okay, but couldn't you have done it a little bit better? Couldn't you have done it this way? Couldn't you have done that way? And God judged them because they tempted Christ. All right, look at the next one. He says, nor should we complain, again, as some of them did, and were killed by the destroyer. This verse is related to Numbers chapter 14, verse 2, verses 36 and 37, again an episode where grumbling or murmuring brings about divine punishment. You ever had a kid, you ever speak to one of your children and then have them turn around and you can't quite make out what they said, but you heard them say something under their breath? Remember that? Remember how mad that makes you? Okay, the Hebrew word that Paul is referring to here, sometimes it's translated grumbling, sometimes it's translated murmuring. That's the word. It was as if God scolded Israel and they turned around and said something under their breath. Here's the problem. Nothing is ever quite out of God's earshot. And so, again, judgment. Now, Paul, the point that he's making here is that idolatry has some inherent dangers. It draws us in a direction that naturally puts us at odds with God. And he uses this whole historical survey of just one Old Testament event after another to build his case. Now, this is where he's going with it. He says in verse 11, now these things happened to them as examples, and they were written as a warning to us on whom the ends of the ages have come. In other words, those of us who are now on this side of Jesus Christ can view those events as warnings of things to stay away from. So whoever thinks he stands must be careful not to fall. In other words, as we see the falls of those who went before us, Paul is saying the minute you think, oh, that can't happen to me, that's when you're in real trouble. Oh, that'll never happen to me. Oh, I'm too strong for that. No. In fact, We can never be weary of doing good, because if we let our defenses down, at one moment the enemy has a way of snaking his way into our hearts. Verse 13, but this is the answer. He says, but no temptation has overtaken you except what is common to humanity. In other words, this is a great encouragement. You are never going to face a temptation except what is common to the experience of being human. Occasionally, rarely, but occasionally, I'll cross paths with somebody, and in essence, they'll say, well, nobody's ever had to go through what I have to go through. Well, my. Fact of the matter is, you're not all that special. What you experience has been experienced before. The temptation that you struggle with is not uncommon to the human experience. But here's the thing. While it ought to be an encouragement that temptation is just a natural part of being human, look at what he says here. God is not a casual observer standing on the sidelines as we go through life. He's active and involved in our lives because he says, no temptation has overtaken you except what is common to humanity. God is faithful. That is, he's involved. He's engaged in your life, and he will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. But with the temptation, he will also provide a way of escape so that you are able to bear it. In other words, no temptation that you face is unique to you. It's a part of the common experience of being human. Secondly, God is active and involved in your life, and he will guarantee that you are not allowed to be tempted beyond your ability to respond. Sometimes we have people say, well, you know, God will never put more on you than you can handle. That is not biblical. That's not in the Bible anywhere. It never says we'll never have more burdens or troubles than we can handle. We often have more than we can handle, which is why God is right there beside us. But the reality is, the Bible does tell us we'll never have more temptation than we can handle.